I have been looking forward to this interview for weeks, if not months, and in years for the book itself. Appointed by Philip Roth and granted independence and complete access, Blake Bailey spent years poring over Philip Roth's personal archive, interviewing his friends, his lovers, and colleagues, and engaging Roth himself in breathtakingly candid conversations. The result is the new book, Philip Roth, The Biography. Bailey shows how Roth emerged from a lower middle-class Jewish milieu to achieve the heights of literary fame, how his career was nearly derailed by his catastrophic first marriage, and how he championed the works of dissident novelists behind the Iron Curtain. He examines Roth's rivalrous friendships with Saul Bellow, John Updike, and William Styron, and reveals the truth of his love life, culminating in the almost 20-year relationship with actress Claire Bloom, who pilloried Roth in her 1996 memoir, Leaving a Doll's House. Blake Bailey is the author of biographies of John Cheever, Richard Yates, and Charles Jackson. He is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and an award in literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. The new book, Philip Roth, The Biography, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Blake Bailey to the roundtable this morning. Blake, thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, thanks. I'm happy to be here.
This book is beautiful. It is exhaustive. It is amazing in what you accomplish here. I am curious as to the origin story on how you came to be the guy to write it.
Well, it was kind of good timing. I had come to New York to drop off photographs for the book I had just finished, which was my biography of Charles Jackson. And I was chatting with another biographer, James Atlas, mm-hmm. who wrote the biography of Saul Bellow, who wrote a biography of Bellow. And we were talking shop, and he said, "Do you know that Ross Miller is no longer returning Philip Roth's calls?" And we in the trade knew that Ross Miller had been Philip Roth's elected biographer for several years. So yeah, I was between books. I thought, what the hell? I had communicated with Philip before because he and Cheever had kind of been friends. So I'd written him a note then, and he had responded. So I dropped him a letter, and I said, you want to talk? And he called me and said that he did, and the rest is history.
What was he looking for in a biographer, and how ultimately did you fill that role?
Well, I think that Philip had a pretty ambivalent view of what he was looking for in a biographer. The epigraph to my book is what he told me at the outset: don't try to rehabilitate me, just make me interesting. Because he knew that he had a public relations problem on his hands, a pretty massive scope. What I told him at the outset was that, you know, Ross Miller had been his best friend. And I said, that's a pretty massive conflict of interest. I'm fond of you, but I'm not your best friend. And also, I made quite a different arrangement with Philip than Ross had. Basically, it was the same arrangement that I'd made with my previous subjects, which is he has to give me everything. And he has to make himself available for interviews, make his friends, lovers, enemies available, and keep his hands out of my business.
And that was never in question, right? That never was an issue for you in keeping those wishes pure.
In other words, did Philip respect the boundaries?
Correct.
Mostly. There were particularly ticklish areas of his life where he took exception. For example, the model for the insatiable Dranka in Sabbath Theater was the longest relationship of Philip's life, longer than Claire Bloom, and that was almost 20 years, and concurrent with Claire Bloom, I might add. I call her Inga Larson in my book. She had been called Erda, another pseudonym, in Claire Bloom's Leaving a Doll's House, and Philip said she smeared me, you know, told a libelous story to Claire Bloom under the protection of a pseudonym, so you cannot give her that protection again in her book. If she speaks to you, she will have to do so under her real name. And essentially I said, Philip, that's not for you to say. That's a violation of our agreement. And so I gave her a pseudonym.
Hmm. The idea of what you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation of a public relations disaster, why did he think that way about himself and his life?
Well, Philip thought that he was unjustly maligned, and to some extent he was. You know, there are a lot of distortions and omissions in Claire Bloom's book. I mean, look, Claire's basic beef is accurate, that, you know, he was a rampant adulterer and that he abandoned her kind of out of the blue. So that much is true. But she also paints him as this kind of sinister Machiavellian character who's bent on persecuting her and her daughter. And that's not really true. And I think I try to be as even-handed as possible in showing that relationship in my book. But I also provide the evidence to suggest that Philip was not like that. And indeed, okay, Claire has often said, once she finished her publicity for the memoir, that her relationship with Philip was the most wonderful of her life.
Mm. When you are writing such a volume of a literary figure, it's fascinating, and I thought of this often as I was reading this book, of the balance between telling about the life and telling about the work, about the literature, its place, its reception, the craft, of course, and then the guy who's writing it, and that life, which is often the case with writers, can be shaggy and or messy.
Yes. You know, Philip's first marriage to Maggie Martinson was even more of a catastrophe than his marriage to Claire Bloom, and that's going some. Basically, he discovered, he was quite young at the time, waiting for his first book, Goodbye Columbus, to come out, and he discovered that she had pawned his typewriter. Okay. And he had already wanted to get rid of her. And he said, you have to leave. And she said, I can't, I'm pregnant. And he said, prove it, and gave her a herring jar, you know, for a rabbit test. And she went to Tompkins Square Park and paid an obviously pregnant woman $2 or $3 for her urine, and thus deceived Philip into thinking she was pregnant, and he married her. And all sorts of disaster ensued from that. Now, for years after Maggie's sudden death in 1968 in a car wreck, he tried to fictionalize that urine ruse, Maggie's urine ruse, and he just couldn't do it because he couldn't improve on the known facts. The known facts were so astonishing. And finally, and I think I show this very carefully, that narrative evolved into what became Portnoy's Complaint. So it's a wonderful sort of puzzle to solve. That's only one example in tracing how the life sort of evolved into the fiction.
One of the things that I found interesting about you and in your career, that as a literary biographer, this is the first time you had written about a subject who was living at the time of your writing. So that has to play an interesting hand in all of this.
It certainly does. You know, he's also my first non-alcoholic. And also,
but he had so much else going
on. Previous subjects were very sexually conflicted. So Philip was kind of a little wary on that score going in. He said, you ever write about someone who wasn't constantly drunk or is dead? And I said, no, you'll be my first. So
yeah,
we proceeded on that basis. Look, for the most part, Philip was very easy to work with because he knew he was coming to the end. And this was his legacy. This was the most important thing in his life. He would be the first to say that. And so, you know, I mean, practically two or three times a week for those first 3 years or so, I would get a fat envelope in the mail which would be a new file from his archives, you know, headed by a memo carefully typed by Philip, telling me what I ought to think about the contents of the envelope.
The idea of talking to him, give us an idea of what your first meeting was like and how you would check in with him throughout the process while he was alive.
Well, our first meeting was almost bewilderingly innocuous. I dropped by his apartment on the Upper West Side. He was recovering from back surgery, so he was in a lot of pain, but he was trying to be charming despite that. A former girlfriend of his, Julia Golier, a psychiatrist who is also the co-executor of his estate, visited during my visit, and I later figured out that I was being checked out, you know, that he had unqualified faith in her judgment, especially of other people. And so that's what that was about. But we didn't talk about the biography per se. And he said, well, why don't you come back in a couple of days and we'll talk more. When I came back, you know, I solicitously inquired about his back. And he said, you didn't come here to talk about my back. Sit down. And, you know, produced this sheaf of paper on which he'd written about 3 hours of questions. The first one being, why should a Gentile from Oklahoma write the biography of Philip Roth? And that was the only question I was prepared for. And I said, you know, I'm not a bisexual alcoholic with an ancient Puritan lineage, but I wrote a biography of John Cheever.
The point to be made about Philip Roth of being a larger-than-life figure that as noted, people tend to love or hate him, and so I guess that sort of colors how people will take your biography, right? Of how they will receive it.
Yes, emphatically so. It is very, very hard to please everybody with a biography of Philip Roth. There have been a couple in particular of the younger reviewers who want to score points, and basically, they have a pretty good idea what they want to say about Philip Roth before they have read or written a word, and they go looking for the ammunition. However, I think more objective reviewers, such as 92-year-old Cynthia Ozick, who reviews my book on the front page of this Sunday's New York Times Book Review, you know, she engages with Philip as a subject, as a great artist and a human being, you know, not someone to score PC points off of. And she calls my book, I say blushing a little bit, a narrative masterwork. So,
well, I would,
for what it's worth.
I would agree with her words, of course, meaning a lot more than mine, but it does come off that way. Do you feel, I felt this way, I don't know if you feel this way, and I guess this gets back to how you go into it, but the book seems to me to be mostly sympathetic to the subject.
Yes, I was very fond of Philip. As many, many people will tell you, it was very hard not to be fond of Philip if you were at all close to him. As I often mention, you know, I was there when he was dying at New York Presbyterian, and he was surrounded by former lovers, okay? This, a man who notoriously has trouble with women, you know, according to public perception. But if you can get 6 or 7 or 8 of your former girlfriends to kiss you goodbye when you're dying, you must be doing something right. So I think that comes across, but you know, I don't go into any project with any sort of preconceived idea about my subject. You know, I let the evidence guide everything, and I give equal time to the bad and the good, and there's plenty of both in Philip's case.
Were there times that, I mean, it must have been, you're asking the man very tough questions, and as his health is declining, what was that like as you know that you have sort of waited for these moments to be right to ask certain questions and that is to get what you want and what you need for your work?
Well, you know, I mean, again, Philip and I were very candid with each other, and usually that went easily enough. Not always, and especially toward the end, he was getting cranky, and he was getting tired of my snooping. One of our last in-person meetings, I mean, I think this was 6 months before he died, and he was in terrible shape. He was recovering from a transaortic valve replacement, and he was so exhausted he could barely get out of his chair and go to the bathroom. I had been to his agent, Andrew Wiley's, office earlier that day looking through files, and I had seen something of a rather damning nature, and I was determined to get to the bottom of it. So I kept asking him questions about it, and he was getting agitated and saying, "This is not in my interest to answer. You need to change the subject." And I wouldn't. Mm. I acted sort of, you know, ho-ho-ho and jovial about it. And he got angrier and angrier. And he paused for a moment and kind of shook himself and said, "You know, this is the best I've felt in weeks, you." And he called me a filthy expletive at that point. But that was Philip, you know. I mean, he, even at his sort of grumpiest and most browbeating, you could always appeal to his sense of humor, and usually with a very good result.
I think I know what I'm asking when I ask this question, so bear with me. But do you, how, what is the sense when he passes, which obviously you know is coming, but what is the sense, does your mood change in your writing as it happens that the dynamic is different, right? Because now he has passed and you are basically finishing the work you started.
I see what you're getting at. I mean, I was relieved for my own sake that I was genuinely mournful when Philip died. Again, he evoked tender feelings out of you. But as a biographer, yes, was there a little relief? Sure, there was. At that point in my writing, you know, Philip's darker qualities really emerged later in life, and it was nice to come to those bits and write about them in a way that was totally unconstrained by an awareness of his living presence.
Mm. Blake Bailey is our guest. The name of the new book is Philip Roth, The Biography. Much has been made, and I'm interested, is you talk about the controversies in his life. Let us talk about his rivalries and his friendships with other writers, some friendly, some not. Where did that rivalry come from, do you think?
Well, in the case of John Updike, for example, Updike made a point of reviewing practically every book that Philip published after, say, 1980 or so. And sometimes he was gracious, and more he became impatient with Philip's work because Philip kept writing about a Philip Roth-like alter ego and, you know, sort of exploring the travails of being an American writer. And Updike said, you know, there's got to be more to a great writer's work than this sort of solipsism. I mean, I'm not saying I agree with Updike, but that was sort of Updike's line. And finally, he reviewed Operation Shylock for The New Yorker. And Operation Shylock is about a character named Philip Roth who goes to Israel, right, because there's someone pretending to be Philip Roth. So Updike is like going, those of you who are tired of Philip Roth presence in his own work now get two Philip Roth. And so it was just a vicious, vicious review. Philip, meanwhile, had always been nothing but generous. I mean, he was not a critic by trade like Updike was, but he always dropped a note to Updike of very well-considered praise whenever Updike had a book come out. So long story short, really, you know, Philip was very magnanimous toward colleagues. If he read a book he liked, whether he'd heard of you or not, he'd drop you a letter saying, "This is a wonderful book," et cetera. "We should get together sometime," and so on. With non-writing friends, Philip could be very petty and grudge-bearing. But for the most part, in these rivalries, with friendly rivalries for the most part, with his colleagues, it was Philip who was the more magnanimous one.
What would he write by? Would he write reviews?
He wrote. I mean, he wrote criticism. He wrote something, and he was a very good essay writer. But he had to have some sort of, he had to be provoked. Okay, like when he was being called a self-hating Jew, he wrote several essays defending himself, rightly so. And in the course of which he would critique other great Jewish writers' work, like in Imagining Jews, he compares his work with Bellows and Bernard Malamud's to quite unfavorably in the case of Bernard Malamud, who was furious. The answer is he was an astute critic. He did write some reviews, mostly early in his career, but later on he was too consumed with writing these vast tragic novels, such as in the American trilogy, to write anything else.
Knowing that you had to write about his about those allegations of anti-Semitism that he had, how did you ultimately decide to address that with him?
How did I decide to address that with him? You mean, did I discuss with him the perception that he was a self-hating Jew?
Correct.
No, neither of us believed that he was a self-hating Jew. That was never on the table. I discussed the controversy.
I mean,
basically, Philip has written about bad Jews and good Jews. He's written about bad women and good women. As he liked to say, Hamlet does not stand for all Danes. Raskolnikov does not stand for all Russians or students. Othello does not stand for all Moors. Okay? You can write about complicated people in a complicated way, and it should not be perceived as damning an entire ethnicity of people.
I guess I never understood the charges. And so where did those ultimately come from?
Well, it started with his first book, Goodbye Columbus. This was 1959. The Diary of Anne Frank was just then being staged on Broadway. Leon Uris's Exodus had just come out. Elie Wiesel was publishing an English edition of Night. And there was a terrible degree of Holocaust consciousness on the part of American Jews who were just after the war becoming more accepted into mainstream Gentile, respectable middle-class society. And here was a Jew, writing about profoundly unsympathetic Jewish characters. Brenda Potemkin, who's a wonderful, charming young woman in Goodbye Columbus, uses a diaphragm so she can have premarital sex. And she was, a nice Jewish girl from an upper-middle-class suburban Jewish family, and that just did not fly. Other characters, Defender of the Faith, is about Private Grossbart, gets out of unpleasant duties in the army by claiming he has to go to shul and, do these devout Jewish things. It's completely hypocritical. And he, whines about being persecuted whenever anything is denied to him. So, people took offense.
In our, we just have about a minute and a half left, but I'll just end with the legacy question of how you think this, your book, which is the biography, helps to place Roth and either change or enhance his legacy.
I hope that it will help his certainly his literary reputation. I'm not entirely sure about his human reputation. I have been surprised by the extremity of certain reactions. I think Cynthia Ovitz gets it right, that this man is a person of massive cultural importance. You know, with Bellow, he's the last word on the American Jewish experience. And what he had to write about male sexuality, whether you like it or not, it's worth your considering. And as for Philip the human being, well, you know, let he who is without sin cast the first stone.
Blake Bailey is the author of the new book, Philip Roth, The Biography. It is published by Norton. Blake Bailey, congratulations on this beautiful work, and I thank you so much for being with us and sharing with us this morning. A delight to speak with you.
It was fun. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the new book is Philip Roth, The Biography by Blake Bailey. It is published by Norton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.